Hello, welcome to Waldman's Words. My name is Scott Waldman, and this is the very first show that we will be broadcasting. I moved to Los Angeles in 2003 with my English degree, joined a band called The City Drive. We signed a major label deal. I did that for a while, played in two other bands, Lido Beach, Greenlight Theory, worked at a law firm for 5.5 years, and now I manage a bunch of bands, a drummer, an unknown rapper, and a producer named Danny Balistocki, who I have to my left. So, Danny, introduce yourself and I guess tell the 17 or 23 people listening right now how we met.
Well, first of all, hello, everybody. I'm Danny and I'm great. And, you know, I just want to say that you should have saved me for a show where you have the biggest fan base already. You know, I deserve at least 50 to 100 people listening. Really, in all seriousness, I've been producing music for the last, somewhere like 10, 15 years. And I've worked with a whole bunch of bands, some bigger, some smaller. For every one big, there's probably 100 small. And that's just the way it goes.
Solid ratio.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm a working producer, and I'm just happy to be here with you, Scott.
Well, thank you. I mean, you didn't answer my question on how we met, but that's fine.
Wait, let's talk about that.
I would like to.
So I used to play in a band. This is really going back like probably 15 years, called Goodbye Valentine. And we were just a local LA band. We did a lot of Warped Tour stuff. We were really part of that sort of like independent punk rock, like DIY movement of, you know, go record an album, go press your own CDs, go hand them out to everybody for free, you know, go tour and tour and tour and go get in a van. And
you're from LA though, right? I mean, I know you spent a few years, you know, of the major pivotal ones of your youth in another undisclosed location.
My infancy was in Portland, Oregon, but I've been in Los Angeles since I was 3.
Okay.
And yeah, I mean, growing up in LA, like being part of that punk rock scene was, it was pivotal for my development, you know. I mean,
it wasn't like Black Flag, Descendants punk rock that you grew up in, right? Because you're a tad younger than that, right? Which punk rock scene would you say was like the quote unquote LA sound?
I would say to a degree it was.
Okay.
Because I got into all styles of punk rock. So I mean, listen, like when I was 12 years old or 13 years old or whatever it was, you know, Green Day, 94, Dookie. That changed my life. That was probably the beginning of it.
Mine too.
Yeah. That was probably the beginning of it. Weezer's Blue Album in 94 was...
Smash in 94. Yeah, 94, yeah. And also, just so you guys know, I honestly think 1994 was the best year for everyone, including me. It's when I had my bar mitzvah. It's when three of my favorite movies of all time were nominated for Best Picture, Shawshank Redemption, Forrest Gump, and Pulp Fiction. So you know how the older people, I guess the baby boom people, well, technically Danny and I are the older people now, which is kind of weird, but are always saying like, my generation was better. I'm just letting you guys know that yes, there's good stuff in 2016, but my generation was better. Continue, Danny.
Yeah. So Green Day kind of opened my eyes to punk rock. And then, I started getting into more independent punk rock. I'm making quote signs with my hands, but
they can't see you.
That.
Like the Fat Wreck and Epitaph. I mean, I mentioned Offspring, but they managed to. Oh, really?
Well, yes, but not yet. The truth is like my segue into like real punk rock was I went to Blockbuster Music, which no longer exists.
Oh,
and
man.
I went to the punk rock section, which
is so punk rock.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was like 14, right?
Yeah.
And I picked up Pennywise's first album.
With the self-titled one?
Self-titled.
Okay.
And Guttermouth. They've had an album called... the album formerly known as full-length LP.
I think Guttermouth got kicked off Warped Tour.
I know that they did. I know that they did. But yeah, so those two albums were the first like real punk rock albums that I liked. And I was like, holy crap. Like, I can't believe this. Like, I actually like real punk rock music. Like, it occurred to me, like, this is pretty cool.
You didn't consider Green Day real at that point? Because I remember in eighth grade, there was this one kid who went up to me. He's like, fuck those poser British accents. It's all about the Sex Pistols. And I'm like, you don't know any Sex Pistols songs. You're quoting your big brother who probably knows God Save the Queen.
Sure. I know that everyone loves and kind of worships Nevermind the Bollocks, but I never really got into the Sex Pistols.
I like that.
You know, I just thought it was okay. It was cool. I mean, and that's fine. I think that's the core of a lot of punk rock music anyway, is a lot of punk rock is about attitude and it's about like the way it makes you feel. So it's not necessarily that it has to be your favorite song. And there are a lot of bands that fit into that category for me, like the Ramones, for example. Like, you know, everyone kind of like worships the Ramones, but like name one like revolutionary Ramones song. You can't when you think about
Blitzkrieg it. Blitzkrieg
Bop. Get out of here.
I mean,
I Want to Be Sedated. Look, these are good songs, but the reality is,
what's your definition of revolutionary?
I don't know. I guess we gotta. You better stop it, Scott Waldman.
I'm supposed to be the Inquisitor. I mean, you're wearing a Nirvana T-shirt. I mean, that was a band that I guess was the gateway to a lot of people's ideals of, you know, just angsty alternative rock. I mean, people call them the first punk band to break. I would call them revolutionary. I would argue that both the Sex Pistols and Ramones, while they're not, you know, like Queen, you know, they're still revolutionary.
Well, the Sex Pistols are fine to me.
That is such a mom answer.
I don't know.
They're fine.
Dude, I just never cared about them. You know, I mean, it's like I said, there are a lot of bands that I think it's like, for some reason, like there's a fucking social stigma if you don't love them. Look, I hate a lot of music and I feel passionately about my right and my privilege to hate all this music.
Well, that's America.
Well, it's like, it is America. But I don't know, like, hold on, Fishkin, are we leaving?
So basically our facilitator, Mike Fishkin, who has a show called Gone Fishkin, had to leave the room. And Danny is so nice that he can't even let that happen.
I am excited.
He's coughing, too, outside the room. All right, let's get back to this. Let's get back to this.
I'm excited. But look, I do think that, like, there are a lot of bands and a lot of artists that you're not supposed to hate. And
I can name about five, right? We should go for go. Like Bob Dylan. You cannot hate Bob Dylan.
Okay, the Beatles.
But you shouldn't hate the Beatles.
Listen, I agree with you.
I get it.
I agree with you. But you're definitely thought of as
a miscreant.
Yeah, you're a weird parasite, you know, if you don't.
Before we discuss more things that we hate, which is always fun for the listener and the people speaking, name a modern band that you have to like, because there's a bunch, you know, on speed dial in my head right now.
Well, a couple years ago, it was Imagine Dragons. And it's funny because a few years ago when Imagine Dragons came out, I kind of just felt like every band that came to my studio would just say, they would utter the same phrases over and over. It was like, hey, you know, we want to be like really like, we want to be rock, you know, but we want to be like modern, you know, like kind of like Imagine Dragons, like add some synths and stuff, you know, like, can you help us do that? And it was like, okay, fine.
But I still think like they're not that kind of band where you're like, they're definitely a band that's influenced a lot of people and obviously influenced pop rock radio. But I'm talking about like, you just cannot say like, I hate the Pixies. You just can't.
Sure.
Because like then you're pretty much like Scarlet Lettered. You know, yeah. Bands like that. And I'm not saying I hate them. I like them. Do I love them? No. All right, let's transition to something else. So, you know, you played in a band called Goodbye Valentine.
Yeah, let's go back to how we met.
How we met was...
I know.
I'm waiting for your transition, bro.
I remember how we met. We met...
Thank you. I remember how we met, too.
We met at... I think it was the Alley?
No.
Is that the name of the venue?
So you clearly don't remember how we met.
No, I just don't remember the name of the venue.
It was a venue called the Troubadour. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
No, the first time that we met was in the Alley.
I guarantee it. I have the poster of that show because it was the first Lido Beach show. Side note, after I quit the City Drive, I started a group called Lido Beach, which I really loved. And our very first show ever, we played with a band called Goodbye Valentine, which had a guy named Danny Balistocki in it, who is to my left.
It's true. And... my last name has four syllables, Balistocki. It's long.
I know. I'm a Waldman. It's not as... I mean, people always say my full name when they're talking about me, like Scott Waldman. I don't know. I just call you Danny. If I say Danny Balistocki, it sounds like I have like an STD.
My girlfriend's last name is Holloway, and I was thinking about taking on her last name if we ever get married.
I mean, it's a little bit less ethnic, so you might get
Danny
more
Holloway work.
Danny
Holloway sounds cool.
Well, tell us about that show that you don't even remember, and then we're going to go into, what you're actually here for.
I don't remember the Troubadour show, but I remember the Alley show, and I remember all of the fans specifically. Those are the people that come to mind that loved us all. And actually, there are a lot of the same people that love the band Film Speed, who is also managed by Scott, who I also just recorded two new songs for. They sound so good.
Mm-hmm. And side note, again, the very first person we did our trial episode, which we're going to be airing later, was Zach James, who you've also worked with.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to survive off of you, Scott.
well, say one adjective to describe Zach, and then I want to hear about, you know, how you transition from, you know, being a guy on stage at the Troubadour in the Alley to, you know, being behind the boards, and, you know, what that transition was like. Because I've co-produced one record, but I mean, you've produced one record today, so sure. I would like to hear about that.
Okay, so you want to know about the transition?
Yeah. Well, one adjective to describe Zach.
Okay, one adjective to describe Zach.
It could have four syllables if you'd like.
Ooh, that's kind of that's that opens up a lot of possibilities. How about sweat, funny, wild, fun?
I mean, those are four words. Wild has two syllables. It's a conjunction. I'll give it to you. That's a good one. And sweat's actually the name of his song. All right, so to recording.
Wait. I just want to say he showed up at the studio yesterday, and he was just like complaining about sweating profusely. It was ridiculous. He's wearing like a three-piece suit. It was like 85 degrees outside.
Well, that's probably the genesis. I wear Old Spice. I don't know. I would love it if Old Spice would sponsor this show, because it smells good, and apparently it's how my grandparents met.
Maybe it could be Teen Spirit. Smells like it.
Wow.
Okay, so
I didn't get a laugh from Fishkin. I got a cough. So that's what just happened. Boom. And oh wow. Too soon.
Too soon.
No, it's okay. We can talk about that later. So recording.
I'll talk about transitioning. Okay. And by the way, I also want to say that I love the fact that you and I can't get through a topic. I know that's probably because of me, but I'm really glad for it.
Well, when people said to me, like, do you think you could fill an hour? And this wasn't referring to you. I'm like, yeah, I think I could do an hour. And like with Danny, it's like, do you think you could fill an hour? I'm like, I'm going to have to get him to shut the hell up.
Yeah, totally. Totally. All right. Well, look, so I remember I was playing music for years and years and years. We went to a bunch of recording studios and we got ripped off at a couple.
How so?
Well, the first one, let's see, well, there was three of us in that particular band I was in at the time. This is pre-Goodbye Valentine.
Give them a shout out.
And I was in a band called, I think this is called Three Skunks, or maybe okay. called Large Marge. I'm not sure.
I remember Large Marge. You told me about that, and I thought that was a great name. Three Skunks, not so much, but Large Marge, that's a
Large
really
Marge
good name.
Large Marge was like the band I was in actuality. It was probably the one that got the most traction, and we got farthest. But, I don't know. You know, I was playing in bands. I was probably like 17 at the time. And I went to a guitar shop. And this is like late 90s. So recording studios were for sure not a dime a dozen. There was no such thing.
As a guy with a laptop making beats. And
there was no such thing as a guy with a laptop at all. Recordings were still done on tape for the most part, especially in home studios. They were done on tape. I think digital 8 tracks were available to...
I feel like Pro Tools was just starting around that point, like late 90s, early 2000s, but you know this better than I would.
So Pro Tools started really in the early 90s.
Oh, really?
It started off as a different program. It's called Sound Tools for a while, and you know they kind of went through a bunch of different incarnations. The reality is that Pro Tools hit the consumer market probably around like 97 or 98.
Uh-huh.
And even as soon as it hit, it was incredibly limited. Roland was putting out a bunch of like digital multi-track recorders.
Explain what Roland is to the pedestrian listener.
Roland is a company that owns lots and lots of stuff, and they make keyboards.
Yeah,
and they.
I'm a Moog guy, but yeah. I love Roland.
Roland's cool. They make cool stuff.
It sounds like an old Jewish man too.
Roland.
Hello.
Huh. My name's Roland.
I'm gonna play some Spin Doctors.
Oh, I do love that song.
Yeah, if you want to call me baby.
So good. So we go to a studio. I found like, you know, those papers that they cut the bottom into slits and like have their phone numbers mm-hmm. with advertisements.
Yeah, I need a bass player, must have own vehicle, can't do drugs.
Totally. Like, you know, you just grab the phone number at the bottom. Mm-hmm. So I found a guy like that said like recording studio, you know, $10 an hour, $12
what?
An hour.
What? Whoa. $10 an hour?
Listen, this is like 1990.
Inflation didn't exist in like the 90s? Yeah.
Look, I don't know. So wow. I was so excited to find something that I thought I might be able to afford. And just to give reference, I believe that minimum wage at the time was probably like $5 an hour.
I think it was. Okay. But $10 anyway.
Yeah, totally. It was super affordable, super cheap. And I was like, okay, fine. So I went with my two other bandmates and we saved up all this money. And we went to this guy's studio. And he had this cool studio in his garage and he had tons of gear. And we just thought it was like the coolest thing in the world. We saw a mixing board, you know, for the first time. And, you know, he had like reference monitors and we're like, holy cow. And, you know, like.
And you still weren't even like, you couldn't even legally buy cigarettes at that time. Like, yeah, you were super young.
I was underage. So we go and we spend however much time recording.
Uh-huh.
And he blows out his set of speakers.
Wait, blows out as in they explode?
He literally like blew one up.
Oh, I thought you were using cool kid because you're 2 years younger than I am. So real cool kid terminology for busting out.
Oh, you mean he was like blowing his shit up?
Yo, he was blowing it out.
Yeah.
You know how like when you say to someone like bad and like you could mean good, but you say bad. Good. I don't get it.
Okay, well, how about this? He
took them out of whatever receptacle they were in?
He accidentally disabled all of his speakers permanently.
Oh, okay. Well, I appreciate that insight.
So he broke one of his speakers and he mixed, I think we did like 6 songs or something like that. And he mixed it all through his PA system and a bass amp. And we had everything dubbed onto cassette tapes because that was the medium of the time. And we didn't listen to the cassette tapes until like the day of our show. We had a big show coming up, and we really promoted this release.
At the Alley or the Troubadour?
It was at the Roxy.
Ooh.
It was at the Roxy. And, you know,
Jimmy Eat World's playing there soon, which is so cool.
Yeah. I love Jimmy Eat World.
Well, that's something we agree on.
Clarity.
Yeah. I saw them on the Clarity Tour. This is my concert trump card for most people, but I saw them on the Clarity Tour with At the Drive-In opening.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It was amazing. But yeah, Jimmy Eat World's my favorite band, not named the Beatles. So I'm a huge fan.
So let's see. So what happens? So we go into this guy's studio. He gives us this product. We get it dubbed on cassette tapes. We're on our way to the show. We listen to it and literally my heart sank. It was the worst recording ever.
And when you're 17, your standards are low as is.
Totally.
And also every single band listening to their own shit, it's like, yeah. So yeah. It's good that you were objective.
Dude, I was literally embarrassed. And I just like looked at my guitar player at the time and I was like, dude, this is a fucking disaster.
What about it? Was it just muddy?
It just sounded horrible. Everything about it sounded horrible. The guitar sounded horrible. The drum sounded horrible. You know, the vocals sounded horrible. You know,
like old NoFX. Like old NoFX.
No. Like
worse.
Like, old NoFX is hard to listen to. That's like the best way to describe
okay.
it. It's like hard to listen to. But this wasn't hard to listen to. This just fucking sucked. Like let me put it like this. Like when you're in a band and you're young, you know, it's assumed that you're gonna suck a little bit. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Tell that
like,
to Silverchair, Danny. Okay.
You know, good point. Touche.
And Daniel then Jones every other band incredible. I will jump off.
Daniel Jones is incredible. But you know, we sucked, man. Like we totally sucked. And this recording highlighted the fact that we sucked because the production was so incredibly bad that like all that was left to focus on was the songs, and the songs sucked too.
Which is the opposite, just so you know, of the opposite of good production. Good production is supposed to highlight certain aspects and make a song sound
sure.
better.
Sure, sure, yeah.
I would hope so.
Yeah, and enhance the good of what's there. I mean, it's all about perspective.
Yep.
You know, good production like gives the listener a better vantage point.
Who's your favorite producer? Quick, quick, quick! Come on. George Martin's mine. Go, go, go.
Favorite producer?
Yeah, besides Danny Balistocki. Go.
It for a long time, my favorite producer was John Feldman.
I thought you were going to say Ryan Green, but that's cool. John.
For a long time, he was my favorite producer. I wouldn't say that today, but I would say that like through the longevity of...
Like used story of the year time?
Like the used story of the year. I don't know if I would say that Hillary Duff was my favorite. I don't know if I would say Paris Hilton was my favorite. I don't really know that I would say that.
You're saying more negative than positive. Of summer is yet, my favorite. Yet he's your favorite.
But I'm gonna tell you something that I do think that for you mentioned Ryan Green, like Ryan Green for Fat Records, like late '90s and early 2000s was, I think, pivotal for recording in general.
He did every single Fat record in the mid '90s.
Yeah, Punk and Drublick, So Long, Thanks for All the Shoes. You know,
Lagwagon, right?
Yeah, Lagwagon.
Me First and the Gimme Gimmes.
Lagwagon, Me First and the Gimme Gimmes. No Use for a Name. I mean, all those bands, and
they had such a sound though. Like when I heard, mm-hmm. you know, like a Lagwagon, I'm just like, that's a distinct record sound. Like kind of like, you know, I'd say like mid 90s Epitaph totally had its own market and totally had its own sound.
Sure.
And Epitaph in 2016, which I applaud, like you can't describe it now. There's everything from hip hop to, yeah. you know, crazy hardcore punk to electronic to pop. But the mid 90s, Ryan Green was the go-to for, you know.
Yeah.
And we were just talking about Mark Trombino, who was the go-to drive-thru records guy.
Sure.
And Jimmy Eat World's Clarity.
Yeah.
Full circle.
So it's funny, like, I think that for a long time, Ryan Green was, he defined what punk rock music should sound like. And I think that for a time, John Feldman sort of carried the torch right after Ryan Green of like, this is what punk rock music should sound like. And, you know, when I listened to The Used first album, and actually more specifically, when I listened to The Used second album,
In Love and Death,
which is...
We'll get more, that got a more orchestral.
Well, it's funny. Nobody liked that album except for
I love that album.
Me and Scott Waldman.
Actually, I would argue that a lot of people like that album. They just did a tour around it, and it sold well. But the hardcore fans, I mean, it's just like with the people who like Blink are like, dude, they suck since freaking Dude Ranch, Cheshire Cat.
Sure.
It's those kids.
I'm that guy.
I hate those guys. Yeah, fucking Nevermind sucks. It's all about Bleach. No, it's not. Nevermind is so much better than Bleach, and so is In Utero. Go back to your rabbit hole.
I'm with you. I'm with you on that. I like the reference, too.
Which one?
The Blink-182 rabbit hole reference.
Thank you.
You know? Okay, so look. Let me go back two steps.
Never mind.
To how I transitioned into producing music, because that's important. So we got ripped off of the studio, and we went to another studio where we also got ripped off. And we went to probably two or three more studios where we got less ripped off.
This is good that you're getting better.
You know,
you needed representation. Look, you needed someone to look out for your band.
What it was is that we were getting a budget together, and we didn't have anyone to guide us in terms of like managing our budgets and saying like, look, like if you just spend, you know, X amount of dollars at a decent studio this one time, right, you're going to save yourself the trouble over spending, you know, a quarter of that four times.
Right.
You know, I didn't.
And the time.
Yeah.
But I have just a quick question, because you're talking about this, you know, this other producer. I'm going to try to reel you in. What about you? Like, when were you at that point where you're like, I could do this better? And how the hell did you know that?
Well, I am going to get to that. But I'll tell you this. This is an interesting story, actually.
Good. I hope this entire show is interesting. I hope that you're not focusing on your B material here.
Oh, you better stop, Scott Waldman. Okay, so I was playing in a band, and...
Was this Large Marge or Goodbye Valentine?
Goodbye Valentine. You know what? I'm just not even going to answer this question because I'm going to get to it in a second.
Thank you for that.
Just hear me out on this. It all segues. It's part of the same thing.
Dude, I'm supposed to control the framework of this show, okay?
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. Go.
So we went to a bunch of studios, and our recordings were getting better. I think in part, one, because we were getting better. I think in part, also...
You mean better as musicians?
Better as musicians, better songwriters, better everything.
But more experience recording, too. Because really? Well, no. More experience, like, actually
being in a studio.
Doing a take. Yeah.
Sure. Totally. So
I just air guitared again. Like, no one will see this air guitar, but I'm telling you, it was a sick diminished chord.
Let's see. So finally, I thought to myself, I should just do this on my own. And I'm going to have unlimited time. And I figured, since our recordings are coming out kind of shitty anyway, I might as well have unlimited time to work on them. So I invested as much money as I could into some recording gear. And I really sucked in the beginning. And I slowly started working and working and working and getting better. Now, a couple years goes by, and I actually got sort of decent, not great. And as my band would play shows, like, we would hand out all these CDs because it was, again, like punk rock DIY, like, listen to this, you know, come to our show, like, take this flyer, you know, whatever. And eventually local bands started saying like, hey, like, I heard your CD, like, you know, where'd you guys record it? And I go, oh, I recorded it.
Aha!
You know, and then they go, well, could you record our band? And I'm like, yeah. And I remember specifically the first band I recorded, I can't remember their exact name. I believe they were called Behind the Census.
Census, like a political?
Census, yes.
Okay.
They're a Mexican punk rock band from Pomona, and they were fucking terrible. I mean, like, they were just as bad as I was, right, when I was, like, 16 years old.
But they took an interest in your work.
They took an interest in my work. And so it was so funny. I remember they said to me, like, so how much would you charge us to, like, record three songs? And I was like, $10 an hour.
Oh,
and
no.
Wait. You're going to love this. You're going to love this. And
did they try to negotiate you down?
No. The band, the funniest thing is that I thought to myself, holy shit, like, minimum wage is, like, probably, like, $6 an hour right now. I'm charging 10. Dude.
Raking it in.
I was like, dude. Yeah, exactly. I was like, I am robbing them blind. I was like, I'm going to get rich. I literally thought that. I'm like, this is awesome. I'm making so much money right now. And the band, they're like, $10 an hour. We're robbing him blind.
Oh. You know, like,
they were so excited.
Well, that's actually hashtag good negotiation when both people leave the situation thinking totally. Like they're in the green.
Yeah.
Quick side note. I never knew that. I've known you for about 5-6 years. Danny was actually at my wedding. He's a close friend and a client. And I mean that, and no fake LA bullshit about that. And I had no idea that's how he got there, but that's almost how I started my management company, which is extremely organically through just a phone conversation with someone about, you know, tactics, you know? So I think that it's cool that you weren't just like, I want to be a producer. That's why I'm handing out these things. You're trying to get Goodbye Valentine more gigs or more fans.
Sure. Yeah.
Then I mean, that's awesome.
I was young. I had no money.
You still are young.
Thank you,
Scott. He has a little bit of money.
You know, I was young. I had no money. And I was like, okay, like, seems cool. I just thought it would be like a project.
You didn't have a business plan?
I had no plans on recording music for a living at this point. And even for the
first... Or recording other people at all, maybe.
At all.
Yeah.
At all. It never was part of the plan. And like, I remember, like, I went from that band to another band. And like, I started to get referrals, and that was weird because I was like, holy cow, like,
they like me, they really like me.
Well, it was confusing at first because I was like, it's so weird, like, I don't have time for my own project and like my own music because I'm just spending all this time recording bands all the time. And so I had to manage the I'm gonna get a little far from the mic. I just had to manage my time a little bit better, and so I went back and forth with that. Anyway, look.
But you didn't go to any recording school. You did it all completely on your own?
Well, I actually did go to recording school later on.
Okay, but that was, I guess, the gateway drug to it.
But, you know, the funny thing about it is that I didn't go to recording school until I was completely proficient in making a living recording. And that was a mistake that I made later on. I'll tell you about that mistake. But now getting to your question a minute
ago. My question from a minute or 20 minutes ago.
Maybe 5 minutes ago, whatever. So, Goodbye Valentine. I'm playing a Goodbye Valentine. And... I had this horrible, horrible, horrible moment where I guess like my deepest, darkest fears kind of they began to sort of creep up on me. And I had a thought, and it was, holy shit, I'm never, ever going to be as good as Paul McCartney. That happened. And it was like a
That's some sobering information.
Totally. Totally. Dude, like, listen.
Well,
like,
just so you know, every single person on the planet who picks up a guitar or bass or starts singing should have that moment immediately. And it'll save you a lot of stress later on.
That's true. But I didn't.
Wow, you are quite like a narcissist that it took you that long.
But it hit me, and it hit me really hard. And I thought, oh my God, like, I can't continue pursuing this.
Because you'll never be the best of all time.
If I don't even have the chance at being the best of all time. Like, look, I always knew I was never as good as Paul McCartney. It's not that I thought I was, you know, on that level, but the idea that I knew I would never achieve that was very stifling for me creatively. And it changed my perspective in a very, very drastic way.
I just want to say a side note to give you a tad ego boost. I have worked with lots and lots of producers, and I've played music with lots and lots of different people, and now I manage a bunch of people. And Danny Balsaki, the guy to my left, no one has an ear for harmonies like this guy. Oh. It's unreal what he can do, and it's cool because when you hear his speaking voice and his singing voice, it's raspy. It's not, I mean, neither one of us are Pavarotti, you know, but he can just hear, you know, the perfect, like, sound for harmonies up and down, like low end, high end, to really, really, really develop the sound and make something really, really thick and, I guess, emotionally substantive.
Well, thank you. Let me just credit my classical music background slash ignoring all of the knowledge that I got from
my classical as in you took piano lessons
as in like I played French horn as like a little kid because my parents forced me.
Well, thank goodness.
I took piano lessons from like 5 years old because my parents forced me.
Mm-hmm.
I was in orchestras as like a little kid in elementary school because my parents forced me.
Well, that teaches you melody. That teaches you timing. That teaches you so much without directly teaching it
totally.
To you.
Totally. Well, it's funny because it was almost like it was ingrained in me. It's like learning a language or something. Because the fact is like I know a lot about music theory, but I don't refer back to it. Like the technicalities and like the bullshit.
You don't just
like,
do the circle of fifths every second?
Look, the rules of music theory and applying that to production or harmonies or whatever, like
it's good to know.
It can be done, but like that just takes all the heart and soul out of it.
I agree with you tenfold. When I went to Michigan, I originally went to Michigan thinking I was going to go to business school. And because it was the number two business school in the country at the time, Wharton UPenn was number one. Congrats, guys. And basically, I took accounting and I took economics my senior year in high school, and I hated it. And I guess I was classically conditioned as an agnostic Long Island Jewish boy that you have to go into business or you have to go into law or you have to go into medicine. There's no other options for financial success. And so when I went to Michigan, I was contemplating different things and I was like, you know what? Maybe I should transfer to the music school. I really love music. And I took a few classes and I couldn't and if any of you guys are listening right now, good, you suck. I couldn't stand the peers in my class and I couldn't stand the classes because it actually took away the joy of music for me. I'm not saying that it won't work for some other people, but I feel much, I think I told you this analogy, like all the people who were studying, it would be the people with their arms crossed, watching someone else perform, being like, I could do that better. And that's, I don't know, I just didn't like that attitude. So now I have the really useful English degree, which caused me to have a radio show at 35.
Nice.
Thank you. Your turn.
So Paul McCartney. So,
whoa!
I realized that I was never going to be as good as Paul McCartney. And that
you're as good as Ringo.
Thank you. That led me to a subtle, but completely real depression for like 3 months.
Oh, wow. I didn't mean to minimize that.
No,
I apologize.
No, dude, it's cool. Like, look, I wasn't debilitated. Like, I can't get out of bed. But basically, like, there was like a... I definitely felt like a dark cloud kind of looming over me for a few months. And I just didn't really know how to deal with it. Because in my life...
It's like when I learned I was never going to be in the NBA.
Look, in my life, you know, my parents had high expectations of me. There was an expectation that I was going to go do well in high school. Yeah, hashtag Jewish. There's gonna be expectation that I was gonna do well in high school and do well in college and, you know, get a good job and be a doctor or a lawyer, whatever. I dropped out of high school. I technically got my diploma early, so, you know, whatever. But really, I took my high school proficiency exam, which in California is the legal equivalent of a high school diploma.
Is that GED?
It's GED pre-18.
Oh, okay. GED is post-18? Yes. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so GED is like...
I should learn more about this.
Yeah, just in case you ever have a kid that decides
fuck
to
up,
screw around.
In case I have a fuck up.
Yeah, exactly like me.
Well, you will be his fuck up mentor because you definitely turned the corner.
So I went and I left high school early, and you know I was doing community college for a while, and I left that early, and you know blah 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 blah, and I disappointed my folks in a lot of ways, and I think that. I think that basically, like, it left me in a position where, I don't know, I just, it left me in a position where I had these, like, high expectations of myself. I figured, like, if I'm going to forsake everyone else's ideals and I'm going to stick with my own ideals.
You mean, like, societal mores?
Not necessarily societal, but, like, if I'm going to disrespect the feelings and the regards and the expectations of, like, my family and my friends... Right, and everybody else that sort of like...
Well, that's a societal mora, but your parents probably extended it further.
Sure. So I thought, you know, if I'm gonna disregard all of that, then I have to really be committed. And so, like, my music, I had this thing, like, music was my identity. It was part of who I was. It was like, you know, whenever anybody talked about me or like, you know, referred to me or whatever, when they thought about me, they were always like, oh, Danny does music. That's what he does.
I always say that we were kindred spirits, and we said that when we met. That's identical to me. I was the kid who made everyone mixes, and I was the one who, you know, performed. And I definitely don't think that, you know, my performance ability is anywhere near your recording ability.
Well,
I just keep throwing these out, not because you're my client, not because you're my friend, but because it's true. I mean, his record speaks for itself. We didn't mention this in the beginning because I do have a template. I really do. I swear I put effort into this, but We didn't talk about the fact that he's worked with bands like Unwritten Law, who I am a genuine super fan of, Metro Station, who's another band, and Rev Run, you know. So he's ran the gamut from, you know, all that, and hundreds, no joke, hundreds of other bands. You might even be in the quadruple digits.
And there's actually more that, you know, I don't go around touting.
Oh, I think I know what you're going to say.
You know,
is he a really talented guitar player?
I might have recorded with Eddie Van Halen.
What?
That was pretty cool. But I don't take credit for that because I recorded an EP at his studio with him, but it was for somebody else. I was producing this girl, and he played guitar on it. So.
But he tracked guitar, and you hit play.
That's true.
So you have technically, you can't say might have recorded. You've technically recorded with Eddie Van Halen.
I have. But look, let me go back to
semi-talented indie guitarist.
Because this is actually really important for me. So I'm walking around with a dark cloud hanging over my head for a few months, and I'm like,
Linus.
I'm like, man, like, what am I going to do? Like, you know, like, I felt like I was living a lie at this point. Because now I'm like, I'm supposed to be this music guy. I'm supposed to be a certain way, and I'm not. I'm literally not. I'm not capable of living up to these expectations. What the fuck am I going to do with my life? And I was probably like, I don't know, I'm thinking maybe 21, 22 at this point.
So you had your quarter life crisis a little early. I had it then
hashtag
too.
Hashtag Jewish.
Yeah. Oh my God. Well, the quarter life crisis begins at birth.
But then it hit me just as easily as the Paul McCartney thing hit me. It hit me like, holy shit. Like, I might never be able to sing as well as Paul McCartney. And I might never be able to write a song as well as Paul McCartney. But I can take a project, and I can take an artist, and I can get them from being as good as they are to so much better, right?
Well, was the Mexican punk band that much better after they worked with you?
You know what? The first one, no. But I would say that, like, with every single artist that I work with every single band that I recorded, every single one, I got better at making other people better, to the point where, like, I would get someone, you know, that, you know, you could rate them like a C minus, and all of a sudden they were representing like a B plus.
That's a solid improvement.
And that was how it was in the beginning. But I realized that I was a natural sort of Quincy Jones, for lack of a better term, that I was, you know, I don't mean to be arrogant.
That was extremely arrogant. Look, Quincy Jones, just for the people listening who don't know that name drop, he produced a little Michael Jackson album called Thriller.
Look, but
which is the most successful album of all time. Just so you know, that, you know, there's been a lot of albums. The most.
Look, the reason I mentioned Quincy Jones by name is not because I'm comparing myself to him directly.
I know.
As much as it is that he is, he defines a producer as being somebody that takes a product and makes it better. In fact,
like a Rick Rubin type?
Well, that's, let me talk about what a producer is.
Yeah, I would love to hear that. That's actually in my notes.
There's three kinds of producers. The first producer is basically a songwriter, a beat maker, okay? That's slang, like, producer has become slang for songwriter or beat maker, and, you know, that's a new school kind of thing. So it's like
producer in film is also slang for lots of different things too. So
sure,
it makes sense.
Sure. So it's
making things happen, that's basically the, I guess, end game, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, look, with these guys, it's like they'll make a beat, they'll sell it to someone, or they'll work with an artist and let them use their beat, their mm-hmm. instrumental, and they're like, yeah, I produce that, I'm a producer. And again, I would call that more of a songwriter, but again, you know, what are we going to do? Attack people's verbiage? Like, obviously not. So, okay, that's one. The next kind of producer is something a little bit more old school, comes more from the 70s. And basically, a producer way back when was an advocate for a record company whose job it was is to be in the recording studio with the artist to make sure that the label's objectives are being met.
So a babysitter.
Basically, he would make sure that that the songs were marketable enough.
And that they weren't too blown out on coke, or sure, they were really blown out on coke.
Sure, sure. I mean, that's how it was.
Blown out. See what I just did there? I didn't even realize that. Listen 22 minutes back.
That was a pun.
Unintended.
Okay, you know, so there's that. And then finally there's, you know, again, like the Quincy Jones producer. And that's a guy that gets together with an artist and listens to their stuff and says, this is how I can enhance you. This is how I can make you better. This is how I can, you know, I envision your stuff with this kind of drum sound. I envision you with this extra guitar part. Or you need to have a keyboard part like this or backing vocals like that. And that was the inspiration for me. You know, I have to be honest with you. I never called myself a producer for years and years and years and years and years. I'm making a living recording, right? I'm working with artist after artist after artist after artist. And every time somebody would ask me what I did for a living, I'd be like, yeah, I'm an engineer. You know, and I represented it as if the only thing I was doing was pushing.
Can you explain, just so people know, what an engineer does in the studio?
Okay, an audio engineer specifically is just the guy that pushes play and pushes record and pushes stop.
He does cable stuff, though, too, right?
For placing microphones on sources, right? And literally just running the session. But there's definitely an understanding and an expectation that the audio engineer is not, I repeat, not responsible for creative input. And it was funny because, like, for years I would call myself an audio engineer. And I had a weird stigma about calling myself a producer.
Did you think it was douchey?
Yeah, I thought it was egocentric and kind of weird and bullshitty, and I was like, fuck, man.
Despite
like,
you getting upset about not being Paul McCartney?
Yeah, I didn't want to misrepresent who I was and what my ideals were, and I was afraid that that word might have too much stigma.
Maybe more so in L.A. even, too.
For sure.
You know, growing up in L.A. and hearing name drop after name drop, I walk into the Coffee Bean and I hear strangers, plural, name drop.
Sure. All day, every day. You can't really escape it here. So I don't know.
Get Spielberg on the phone right now.
But
I heard that once.
You know, look, a couple, I don't know when it was, but, you know, a few years ago, it occurred to me that by not using the term or the phrase or the name or whatever, just the word producer, I'm probably misleading people more than I am just by saying audio engineer. So I started calling myself that along the way.
Do you know what I say in my pitch emails? I don't say I manage, because even though I am an artist manager and technically your manager too, I say I'm working with, just because it's how it comes off. Because for some reason, when I say I manage, it sounds like you're subservient.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's all about verbiage and semantics. And the craziest thing about, you know, today's world is that one person could read an email or hear a statement and interpret it one way, and then another person could take it the complete wrong way and get absolutely offended by it. So I understand why you might have wrestled with that. But going back, so you become a producer. You said this is how you make your living. Let's talk about the actual business aspect of it, because you have your own studio. I would love to hear about that. And I heard a rumor from you that you built it yourself.
Yeah. Okay, this is kind of a funny story. I was working at a bigger studio, and I had an opportunity to leave and work on a pretty big album with a different producer. He asked me to assist him. And when I did, that album fell through. The producer got into a big fight with the record company. And they didn't pay him on time or something like that, and the whole thing was canceled. And
can you be specific as to who it is?
That band was Rise Against.
Never heard of them.
Yeah. So the album was canceled. It wasn't, like, obviously permanently canceled, but they ended up recording it back in Colorado.
Was this a Blasting Room?
I'm not gonna say.
Oh, he's not gonna say. He did not nod or shake his head. But just so you know,
Bill Stevenson.
We mentioned The Descendants earlier, yeah, and Stevenson. Black Flag.
So good. He's a friend of mine. Well, I said a friend, but he's been like he's been a family friend of mine for a long time.
What?
And yeah, Bill Stevenson is.
He's so talented.
He's an inspiring drummer and producer, and in fact, he's much less of an engineer and much more of a producer. And
I heard he's very hands on. Totally. I mean, he's a drummer, so literally he's hands on.
He's incredible.
Did you
talented.
See the Descendants All documentary?
No.
I gotta lend it to you. Cool. It's really good. And I'd say he is like a third of it.
I want you to know, the first time I met him, he like literally came to my house and like it was like for a family barbecue.
Had wiener schnitzel and coffee. And,
you know, I answered the door and I was like, "Are you Bill Stevenson?" He's like, "Yeah." I'm like, "Holy shit." He's like, "What?" I'm like, "Dude, you're fucking Bill Stevenson." And he's like, "So?" I'm like, "That's so fucking cool." He's like, "Stop being weird."
And they're
like,
so not a rock star band.
He's like, I'm like, "Dude, you're Bill Stevenson." He's like, "So what?" I'm like, "That's so cool." He's like, "Stop being weird." I'm like, I can't.
There is only one celebrity that I freaked out meeting. Guess who it is? It rhymes with Bulk Bogan.
Oh, I stole $60 from Hulk Hogan.
What? Okay, yeah. Now you got to talk about that.
I stole 60 bucks.
I didn't expect this transition.
By accident. Oh, my
no,
God.
No. You can't say stole by accident. Like, you would say I accidentally took.
Listen to me. I accidentally stole.
No, that's not possible.
Oh, God. Okay.
Explain that. This is my bar mitzvah theme, by the way. Not accidental theft, but wrestling.
The short version of it is that when I was in my early 20s, I had a dead-end job at a kiosk at the mall selling baseball caps. Hulk Hogan and his son,
Nick. I met Hulk Hogan at the mall, too, at the Century City Westfield.
Oh, so I was, you know, Hollywood and Highland?
Yes. No, I've never heard of it.
Oh, whatever. Quit being mean to me.
Do you know Times Square?
I'm at the mall. And I'm at the mall and, like, Nick, Hulk's son, is like, I really want this cap and I needed like such and such sewn on it. But we had like a wait of like 4 hours. I'm like, look, I'm sorry. Like, I can't just put you ahead of everybody else. Like, there's a 4 hour wait. Whatever.
Do you know who my dad is?
And he's like, okay. And like, Hulk comes over to me. He's like, he's like, can you get this done for me? And I'm like, yeah, but look, I mean, I've got all these other caps in front of you. I'm sorry. And he's like, well, look, can you like ship it to my house? And I was like, sure. He's like, look, just get it done and have it shipped to my house. And he writes down his address, right? And he's like, how much is it going to cost? I'm like, I don't know, right? And he's like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, we don't normally do this, but, you know, whatever. And he's like, okay, well, look, like, here's $80. It should cover the cost of the hat and cover the cost of the shipping, right?
And he's we're going to get back to music in a second.
And I'm like, okay, fine. And I thought, well, I didn't want to ring it up incorrectly, and I wanted to ask the people at the company, you know, like, how to handle this. Well, I lost his address, right? He wrote down his address, and I literally lost his address. And I'm like, great, dude. Like, and I felt terrible.
Right? So you pocketed money from Hulk Hogan. You didn't steal it. You're just a fuck up.
Well,
is that better?
Well, yeah. So then I just pocketed the money, and that was it. And what's actually even funnier is that I ran into, at the same mall, I ran into Hasselhoff, right? I ran into David Hasselhoff randomly. Hollywood High, there's always like events at the theater next door,
right,
or whatever. So
the Oscars.
So Hasselhoff is there, and I like literally run up to him. I'm like, I accidentally stole something from Hulk Hogan. I need you to give me his address. And he's like, what? I'm like, I know it sounds crazy, but I know that you guys know each other.
I got to use that, right, line.
And he's like, he like literally looks at me. He's like, what the fuck is wrong with you? I was like, I feel guilty. Wait, this is even funnier. So the same fucking day, I'm not even kidding you. The same day I see Hasselhoff, I see Hulk Hogan. He shows back up at the mall, and it occurs to me that he probably realizes that I did jack him, right? For $60 or $80 or whatever it was. And I'm thinking, oh my God, like, what am I going to do? I was like, well, I might as well just go up and talk to him. I might as well say something to him instead of him saying something to me. So I go up to him, and I was like, Hulk? And he just looks at me and, like, you know.
Do you think he remembers who you are?
Full, like, glasses. I don't know if he remembered who I was, but I just assumed because I was in front of, like, the same kiosk that he right. would. So I go up to him, I'm like, Hulk? And he just kind of, like, looks at me and, like, tilts his head up, like, full on, like, tinted glasses, like, bandana. Like, he's in the full garb for whatever, like, event.
Sleeveless shirt.
Sleeveless shirt, the whole nine, like, extra tan. And I'm like, oh, my God, dude. Like, this is like, this is so crazy. And I'm like, look, I don't know if you remember me, but do you remember, like, you know, you're with me and your son, Nick, and, like, you know, he ordered a hat and blah, 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 and you gave me money for it and whatever. And, like, you know, I've still got the hat, but, like, I literally lost the address and I don't know where to send it to. And I feel really bad. I didn't mean to take your money. And, you know, I just looked at him and he looks at me and he just starts shaking his head from side to side. And I was like,
like, he's going to drop a leg drop on your neck?
I literally thought he was, like, saying, like, not, like, nodding his head no, as in, like, you are about to get, you made a mistake, right? And you are about to get roughed up. That's really what I thought. And I just, like, looked at him, and I was like, what? And he's just, like, silent, and he's just, like, nodding his head no. And I'm like, oh, my God, like, what is it? And then I looked at him, and I took a good look, and I'm like, you're not Hulk Hogan.
Oh.
Like, no, I'm like, you're an impersonator. And he literally looks at me and he tilts his head. He goes, yep. And
I go, so he thought you were extra crazy.
So
the impersonator on Hollywood Highland yes. thought you were nuts.
So great.
All right, we got to shift here. I just want to talk. That's an incredible story. So, oh yeah. So we only have a few more minutes. So I just want to say that I manage you with Ross Roby. Give Ross a shout out.
Ross is so great. He is just the best manager on the planet.
Hey!
Parallel.
Okay. Right?
And next to Scott Waldman. Equal.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And Ross had a request that you would, you know, say at least one story about an artist you've worked with, good or bad, whatever you'd like.
I have.
And close it off with some advice for the now 29 listeners.
Okay. Well, let me just say that one story of an artist that I've worked with.
You're shivering.
Well, I don't really know
you
what to
say. You name dropped Hogan and Hasselhoff. You could do this.
I love Hogan and I love Hasselhoff. So actually, I'll tell you like a random story. So Juliette Lewis plays in a band called Juliette and the Licks. And she came to my studio two years ago, to record a couple songs with her band. And she brought her dog. And I am a huge animal lover. I have two Bengal cats at home and I love dogs and I love all animals. And
except humans
but I really 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 love animals. And her dog just absolutely and I had an assistant at the time. His name was Zeus. Shout out to Zeus. He's busy making cues for TV and commercials these days. He is afraid of dogs because as a kid a dog bit him. All right, he freaked out. Anyway, long story short, Zane is Zeus.
That's why I did that.
Zane is Zeus. The dog loved Zeus, and the dog hated me. And the entire session, the dog was just literally biting my ankles and peeing on
ankle
me,
biters.
And just you know barking and you know being nasty and snarling at me, and just like crawling into Zeus's lap and just loving him and licking him. And it was
payback's
miserable.
A bitch, isn't it? All right, so we're almost done with this. Just a quick reminder: you can tune in to Waldman's Words on Adobe. I'm not sure the exact time, but it will be announced soon. Hopefully, our socials will be up and running. We have a Twitter, Waldman's Words. That's WALDMAN Words, not just any man, Waldman. We've got Twitter, Facebook, all that jazz. I'd like to really, really thank Danny Balistocki, my producer, homie, client. You should totally, totally listen to his catalog. And if you're a musician, his studio is in Hollywood, Revolution 9, which is a Beatles reference, recordings. And I guess we should just close this out with anyone who would be willing to listen to this. What advice do you have for anyone who's trying to do what you do, which is literally pay your rent by being an engineer?
Okay, well, I could do an entire hour on that.
I know you can, and I'm going to simulate wheels in a car with my fingers in two sentences or less. What would be your advice?
Start working with local artists.
That's
one. You have to get good.
That's two. Thank you, Danny, very much.
That's it.
Okay, fine. Go.
You have to get good. You have to learn how to generate clients. You have to learn how to generate business. You really should apprentice under somebody who's more experienced than you. It's going to save you a lot of time and a lot of trouble.
That's something you didn't do, but you learned by yourself. And also, just so you know, Danny learned about all this pre-YouTube, pre-all that, all those free resources. And those free resources are fantastic, but nothing beats actual grinding.
For the record, YouTube has a lot of misinformation.
That's true.
I do watch a
guitar
lot of those.
Guitar tabs, too. Oh, my
Look,
God.
Look, I watch a lot of those videos because I'm curious. And I got to tell you something. There's a lot of bad information out there. So, I mean, you know, I wholeheartedly think that everybody should engage with all of the with all the resources that are available to them online. But, you know, it's hard. You got to use a little bit of discretion and just trial and error to find out if you agree with what somebody says.
And I have one more question for you. What is your favorite song of all time?
Imagine by John Lennon.
That's a good closer.
Yeah, I think that's the best song I've ever heard.
I would argue that it's a good one.
It might be. I've thought about this before.
Cool.
What about you?
You know, it used to be A Day in the Life by the Beatles, but actually I should change that right now so that we're not just saying Beatles songs. There's a song by a band called Superdrag called Unprepared that I really connect with. So
Sucked Out?
No, that's a different one, but that's my 90s cover band covers that. Anyway, so if you get nothing else from this listen, re-listen to Imagine by John Lennon. He's one of the four, the Fabs. And listen to Unprepared by Superdrag. And special thanks to Mike Fishkin for sitting in this room and helping us out by being the engineer for this session.
Yep.
And to Adobe, and tune in. Thank you.
Love you.